Michelle has been teaching retreat in Upper Burma for the last coming on 25 years. For most of that time with a beloved monk, teacher, colleague, Saito Ulakana, until he passed away a few years ago. And I've been helping with that retreat for something coming on 10 years. And it's been an important part of my ongoing connection with our tradition and lineage and all of the beauty and struggle that that has evoked. And this past year, I was able to get there a little earlier than usual and had some time to kind of visit around a little more than I often do. Most of the time, we're pretty consumed in this kind of one area, this one monastery, this one village. And so I had a chance to go up to a kind of very famous and beloved pagoda. Kind of complex in Mandalay called Mandalay Hill. And it sort of generally is kind of in a valley around the Irrawaddy River, but there are a few sort of more dramatic hills and what you'll find across the countryside is many hills. The highest point will be the home of a pagoda, a temple, a stupa of some kind, a sort of really reflected as a sort of the value of the highest and the utmost and the beauty of that kind of honored. And this is a big enough hill that it's a journey getting up, and there's many stairways and different paths leading in different directions, and lots of little stupas and pagodas and vendors and people who live there. So it's a very integrated place in terms of culture and livelihood and spiritual practice, and very touristy. So I got there as early as I could in the morning, and walked up before the vendors were open and they were all having their breakfast, and it was nice to be able to be there in a sort of more quiet time. And some there are places where it's important to read the signs. It had been a number of years since I'd been there, so and I was trying to kind of figure out which way I was headed. I got to a place getting towards the top, and there were two signs, and one sign had an arrow pointing, and it said to the summit, and there was another arrow pointing with a sign that said to the two snakes. And normally you'd think, "Oh, what a difficult decision, right?" But what I love about this tradition and honor and the honesty and the beauty of it is that both arrows were pointing in the same direction. And it was like, right. There isn't that sense that, oh, this is the path where you avoid all of the dukkha and the hardship, and this is the path where you go into all the craziness and the dragons. It's really deeply ingrained, this understanding that no, they're both in the same direction, right? That to get to the summit, you have to, have a relationship with the snakes of one kind or another. And I think that's hard, that's there's times where we may feel motivated by that, right? We have that sense of sort of courageous energy and the valor that we understand that this path is about, deep and direct engagement with our suffering and the longings of the heart. And then, there's other times where that is difficult, where we really do just want that bliss and that relief, and the relentlessness of experience, you know, is just very hard. You know, there's that that acknowledgement again in the tradition that the dukkha, the unreliability, undependability, sometimes translated as suffering, hardship, stress, strain, you know, that it can come from the, you know, having contact with that which is unpleasant, right? Painful experiences that happen to us in the body or in mind. Or it can also come from the loss of that which is pleasant, right? Because everything is changing and undependable and impermanent, even that which brings us happiness and some degree of satisfaction dissipates. And so there's the suffering of anicca, of loss. But there's also this acknowledgement of the suffering, they call it sankhara dukkha, of formations. There's just something about the relentlessness of being and becoming, this flood of experience that doesn't stop, that's overwhelming, right? That there's a weariness that can come from that, a tiredness, a sense of incapacity to just keep our heads above water amongst this, you know, ever-changing environment we find ourselves in. And so there's times where we feel that courage to show up for the hardship, and then there's times where it really just feels like hardship. And, you know, we have to call upon other resources internally of how do we relate to these difficult mind states, difficult physical sensations, the challenges that feel like obstacles, but of course on some level we know are integral to our path, that actually they're not in the way, that actually without a relationship with physical pain, with emotional pain, without really deeply understanding it, we know we can't actually liberate the mind, right? That we're not just cultivating kindness and love and only building a relationship with those things. That we have to build a profound, honest, clear, tender relationship with the full spectrum of our existence, of the human mind and heart and body. And in some ways, just the experience of being that's beyond human or non-human. In the Itivataka, the Buddha addressed a group of monks and nuns. He said, "One who has not directly known and fully understood conceit, who has not detached their mind from it and abandoned it, is incapable of destroying suffering. But one who has directly known and fully understood conceit, who has detached their mind from it and abandoned it, is capable of destroying suffering. Humankind is possessed by conceit, bound by conceit, and delighted with being. Not fully understanding conceit, they come again to the renewal of being. But those who have abandoned conceit, and who by destroying conceit are freed, have conquered the bondage of conceit and overcome suffering." And then there are six other suttas with the exact same phrase, except for instead of conceit, it's greed or hate, delusion, anger, contempt. And then the final one is the all. Right, so anyone who has not directly and fully understood greed, hatred, delusion, anger, contempt, who has not fully connected with, understood, and abandoned the all, cannot be free from suffering. And then this sense of this person who has, that they have conquered the bondage and overcome suffering. There's something I just feel like so powerful in that, so beautiful, and so daunting, really, right? To really, if you really take in that, you know, every, you know, as we sit here and try to build a relationship with ourselves, with the phenomenon of self, of being, of existence, as it unfolds, you know, to really understand that every single moment of experience is worthy of our attention, worthy of our care, worthy of this relationship of understanding, understanding to the degree of disenchantment, of letting go, of unbinding ourselves from it. That's quite a call, right? It's not just that, oh, you know, those people who have fully known love and fully known, you know, patience and all of the beautiful qualities that we have. Actually, it's a very profound understanding that we need to have a relationship with these other parts of our mind, with these corners of our being that we're afraid of, or embarrassed of, ashamed of, that we don't maybe even acknowledge. And yet, this sense of how do we build this process of coming into those realms, coming into relationship with them in a way that we're actually capable of deepening our mindfulness, capable of deepening our care, rather than undermining ourselves, rather than trying to fight dragons that we actually aren't in any way capable of attending to. And so you see in the method, right, that we're not starting with like anger as your anchor, right? It's not like, let's just think of like the person who's done the worst, you know, and just, you know, try to understand the anger and try to, you know, it's like, oh man, you know, no, you know, we start with the breath or our hands, you know, it's like trying to find like a basically neutral experience, you know, of our, you know, that's relatively available. It's hard, you know, it's not easy. And so it's a big part of why we give these options of understanding that sound actually might be safer, more comfortable, more, a little bit less, we're less identified with sound in some ways, in many ways often. And so the sense that we can control it, the sense of self-blame or judgment isn't there. Sometimes these things that are so evocative, if we try to bring the attention into the body, into the breath, into other parts of our being. You know, the breath is considered, of course, a very classic object for our practice. And there is something there where, you know, it's basically regular, right? That it's not incredibly painful for most people. It's not incredibly evocative for most people, but that's just not, it's not totally true either. You know, I'm someone who always grew up with like asthma and allergies and had a really hard time with, my breath was not a safe place, right? It was not like a neutral place to bring the attention. And how many years of practice did that feel like it was like, oh, I was a failure at it because the breath was just like, you know, I was always snotty or asthma-y or whatever, you know, and it's just like, oh, God, you know, and this sense of like, when you realize like, it doesn't matter at all, like there's actually nothing important about the breath. It's not, outside of metaphor, it's not more sacred than your toe, right? It just has these sort of qualities that are often good for many people. And so for me, actually, having that bigger field of like the whole body seated and allowing the attention to be drawn into the sort of various aspects of bodily sensation was a much easier doorway once I kind of let myself explore it, let myself kind of get out of the idea that I should be able to concentrate on the breath. And then, of course, over time, feeling that sense of more safety, security there and in sound, you know, and having a harder time with narrowing the attention on the breath or hands or like a smaller place. It's like, oh, you go where your strengths are. You go with what feels more, you have more natural capacity and you build your relationship there. And that for me, it was very powerful to be able to do that. And then at times, of course, the breath would be more noticeable and I could build a relationship with it from a place of stability, right? From a place of some confidence and some sense of capacity. And to just really remember that, you know, we don't have an agenda really of what your anchor should be. There are some things that we're more cautious of, right? That you can see we do really emphasize to, if you're going to follow the breath, to use your abdomen instead of your nose. And that's really a matter mostly of like concentration and around just kind of how stuck we are in our head so much of the time, right? That we're so involved in thought, we're so identified with this being so important that there's a value in kind of like drawing the attention a little bit away from that, getting a little bit outside of our heads. And also that the sensations here on the tip of the nose, they can start to be so subtle and so refined that they're also good for more of the fixed concentration practice that Michelle was talking about the other day, right? Where you stop noticing the change, you stop noticing the fluctuation, the subtleties of that, and you can get kind of like super zeroed in on just the sort of consistency of sensation, on the fact of sensation there. And that it creates for our approach an imbalance between how much mindfulness and how much concentration we want to be cultivating. So we are going to encourage, if you're doing the breath, to move, you know, to draw it towards the abdomen, which is much less clear. It's much harder to actually keep the attention in the abdomen than in the nose, right? Because it's more vague and for much of the time. And that's sort of part of the point. It's harder to get concentrated here. And so there ends up being a little more of a balance between concentration and mindfulness that we have more confidence in. But if you've trained for years and years with this as your anchor, we also don't want to yank it away, right? There's a sense of appropriateness to our process of where do we open, where do we start to explore different degrees of concentration and mindfulness, where do we start to be more and more inclusive of more of our experience and not use our anchor, wherever it is, as a way of avoiding more and more of what's there in the mind, what's there in the body. Because we can, for sure. And then, you know, we continue to have this dance of getting that, there's nothing that's totally neutral for very long, you know, and understanding that no matter what, you know, from your first sitting through this day, through every day occurring, you know, we're going to encounter more intense sensation in the body, in the mind, heart. And this question of how do we relate to that, right? What are our initial impulses? You know, how do we explore this relationship with the spectrum of our mind and body? And so, of course, there is that sense of, if we're building a sense of capacity, of home base, of safety, security in an anchor, like the breath or the hands, the body, sound, yes, there's a value of being able to see that when something more challenging arises, we have this choice to make, right? That we're not just automatically going back to the breath or going back to our anchor. There's a sense that we can, that we know it's there, we know we're building a relationship with it of strength, of solidity, of comfort, of connection. But that if a difficult emotion arises, or an irritating sound arises, or a physical sensation that's calling the attention that's very difficult, there is this invitation, right, to say, okay, we know that this practice isn't just about getting concentrated on the breath. We know that there is a call to be able to build mindfulness and kindness with whatever's happening. So can we open to this sound? Can we open to the sound and what it evokes in the mind, heart? Can we be curious about it, right? Just that basic level of interest. Can we be genuinely interested in the phenomena of the vibration at the ear? And how does that create, what are the steps, what is that process by which that turns into sadness or hopelessness or rage, right? A sensation in the back, you know, our lower back, or a little twinge in our knee. You know, we're so sensitive. We're so incredibly sensitive. And this process of between mind and body is happening so quickly, it's very hard to see. And so this question of like, okay, when something arises, can we explore it? Do we have the courage? Do we have some sense of capacity and faith that we can check it out, that we can actually bring the attention into something unpleasant and explore it? So that's partly why when you look at the Mahasi Sayadaw reporting instructions, you know, this sense of part of how we're designing, how the method is designed to look at it is to say, okay, it's not just pain in the knee. That's that sort of like, oh, I have knee pain. And instead to bring the attention to that area and sort of be like, okay, pain is an idea. Pain is an overlay of a huge realm of experience. What is happening really here right now? What does this feel like? Is it throbbing? Is it hot? Is it stabbing? Is it pressure? Is it tightness? And that sense that it's actually not consistent, right? The sense that if you look at it, there is change happening. There is movement. There is motion. That it isn't just a block of dukkha. That it's a river of dukkha, right? It's there's many flavors of it, and that it's interesting, you know? And that perhaps it actually isn't just dukkha, right? That maybe there are actually places where there's warmth that's not painful, right? Or that there are things that are not so unpleasant, that it fluctuates, but that the parts that are unpleasant are dramatically so. And so that, and then to see what is the emotional response? You know, that the intensity and the clarity and the piercingness of how one unpleasant sensation can lead to so much overwhelm emotionally, and fear and anxiety and triggering memories about how when we hurt ourselves in the past and what it means about our future. You know, it's amazing. And to have that sense of compassion for the mind, right? It's like we can beat ourselves up for saying, oh, the mind is thinking about the future or worrying about the past. And it's like, actually, often when we're really consumed by those kinds of thoughts, it is because there might be some experience that's really hard to be with, right? That the mind doesn't feel like it has the skills in that moment to just be with in a clear, clean, interested, mindful, kind way. And so there's this sense of like, oh, okay, of course we're afraid. Of course we're afraid of pain. Of course we don't want to be hurt. Of course we're worried about our future selves. Of course we long for or have remorse about past, our sense of past self. And that we start to surprise ourselves with the ability of the mind to actually be with something unpleasant. And to know that there are times where it's so important, it's so strengthening to say, okay, here's a pain in the knee, here's something unpleasant, and I'm going to try to be with it. I'm not going to try to make it go away through loving kindness. I'm not going to try to breathe into it so that it dissipates, right? It is about like, I'm going to be with it. I'm going to acknowledge this is real. This is what's happening. And actually, there's times where you can have a sense that the mind, heart can be with it, even in moments, right? Can touch into it. And it's incredibly important to at times have that sense of strength, have that sense of capacity, because it is evidence of the potential liberation of the mind, right? That if you can be with one unpleasant physical experience for one moment, in a way that's different than just recoiling and running away, then that just means everything. It shows that it's just a matter of training. It's just a matter of the mind becoming more and more familiar with the broad range of our body and mind experience. And that if you can do it for one moment in one place, you know that ultimately you can do it every moment in every place. And that is the promise of this practice, that ultimately that the mind doesn't need to run from anything, right? That the mind is so well-versed and so fluid and so comfortable and so strong and nimble and light and fluid and clear and tender that it can show up for whatever's happening without rejecting, without clinging, and as it passes, without rejecting or clinging. And then there are going to be plenty of times where we realize we don't have the capacity to be with something difficult. right? At where we see that actually trying to stay with an unpleasant experience is actually digging us into a hole, right? Where there's actually not mindfulness available. There's not tenderness available. You just start to see you're digging more aversion. You're creating more wanting of something else to happen. And you start to, you get kind of pulled into this quicksand that we lose more and more capacity to kind of get out of. And so that's when you have this, the call towards this versatility, right? That this isn't just about courage and showing up for all the intense stuff. It's also about skillfulness and moving away when we see that we're digging ourselves into a hole, when we see that we're actually cultivating more aversion or more fear or more incapacity to be with what's happening. And so we have to have that sensitivity too, right? The sense of like, oh, there's times where we do need to run. There's times where maybe we run back to the anchor, and maybe we will find that that's not far enough, right? It's like, we need to open the eyes, we need to go for a walk, we need to really get some distance from something that has arisen. And to just understand that that's not cowardly, that's skillful. That's you know, this... The Buddha will talk a lot about, you know, there's elements of the tradition where it's like, you know, the we're warriors, and you know, it's like the army of Mara and our army against them, and there's this, like, you know, these military kind of metaphors, and you can see there's a place where it can feel like that. There are times where it does feel like that intense, but to recognize we don't have this army, right? We're like a little guerrilla band who, you know, can like go in and like runs to the hills and hides. And we protect ourselves and we heal ourselves, and then we go in and we run back, right? It's like that's the reality of what our capacity is most of the time. And so you train that way, right? It's like we go in when we're strong and we run when we're weak, right? And to really understand that that is actually incredibly skillful, and it builds a sense of capacity. You don't get to the place where you start undermining your sense of confidence in the practice or in your own heart and mind, right? That you build that sense of like, oh no, this is skillful to move to safety right now. And to trust that tide of moving in and moving away and moving in and moving away. Sometimes that's conscious and part of our the understanding we have of decisions we're making in terms of where the attention is moving. And then a lot of the time, you'll just see that's happening naturally. The mind has intimacy with what's happening in the body, and then there's distance. There's intimacy with what's happening, and there's distance. And that actually, there's some part of that rhythm that is of much more subtle degree of volition involved. Right, and there's an attunement to that, and an understanding that, oh, there's times where we drop in, where the calm is there, and the energy is there, and the interest is there, and the, you know, concentration is there, and these things all kind of line up, and you're really with it. And then there's plenty of times where those things just aren't. Conditions are not so favorable for all of those things, and so that we tread more carefully, right? We're less ambitious. We're more humble in terms of, okay, this is actually, I'm low energy right now. I'm not trying to, you know, really dig into whatever is arising. When you recognize there's sleepiness, you have to be careful about doubt, for example, right? We're more, when there's not a lot of energy, we're more susceptible to doubt, to fear, to worry. And so you have to be more vigilant about the mind in those places. When you see it start to move to something more pleasant, something that brings buoyancy, that brings lightness and levity to the mind. In the Visuddhimagga, it's not in the Visuddhimagga. It's in other Abhidhamma commentarial pieces of the tradition where they talk about the sort of 25 different wholesome mental factors. It's a kind of this compendium where they just break down all of the wholesome mental factors, all the unwholesome mental factors, and kind of how they're all related, and, you know, what leads to what. And it the Buddha didn't get so much into all the, like, math of it, you know. But folks later felt like there was some value to it. And so there's just something about this particular list that I just want to offer. So the first seven of these wholesome mental factors, faith, mindfulness, wholesome moral concern. The translations are tricky. They call them moral shame and moral dread. And it's just, we'll talk about that later, but it, you know, the basic idea that like that there is a wholesome place for understanding the impact, the negative impact of our actions, and that we want to be so careful about our actions that part of that is fear of doing wrong, and a wholesome remorse for wrong we might have done, which is different than the kind of remorse that can really that we can drown in. Generosity, love, equanimity. And then you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, these 12 other factors. Kaya pasadi, chitta pasadi. Kaya lahuta, chitta lahuta. Kaya mudita, chitta mudita. Kaya kamanyata, chitta kamanyata. Kaya pagunyata, chitta pagunyata. Kaya jukata, chitta jukata. And these are tranquility in regards to the body and mind. Lightness and buoyancy in regards to the body and mind. Malleability, elasticity, suppleness, pliancy in relationship to the body and mind. Wieldiness, workability, dexterousness, proficiency, mastery, uprightness, straightforwardness, honesty in regards to the body and mind. And I just think there's something so beautiful about that and so different than how we often will tend to approach our practice, right? That when, I think I was saying earlier, it's like there's a tendency when we sit down to meditate, this kind of like, you know, like you're digging in and there's just like, and it's like, whatever that is, that's not on that list, right? It's not like, you know, there's like this sort of like, it's like a little kind of like spiritual constipation, you know? Kind of like, where it's like you're going to do something and there's a sort of like pressure building to do it, you know? I was thinking of like when you see like a little baby who's like has to poop and they don't know what's going on, you know? It's like just like confusing and they make this face. It's like that's what's happening a lot in, you know, in our minds, that little face. And that's so, it's so different than, it's like, oh, just think about this pliancy and elasticity and malleability and lightness and wieldiness, proficiency. You know, there's nothing like hard or unwielding or firm in any of those things. You know, these qualities that are about like dexterity and nimbleness and lightness. And just like, how much of that are you orienting towards when you sit down, you know, when you're doing your walking? How much, when you sit down and you're like opening the attention to sound, to the body, to the breath, it's like, you know, to really consider that, to consider that these are incredibly regarded, like highly valued, considered of the only, of the 25 wholesome mental factors, you know, these are more than half of them. And so it's like, really to take that in. And to be very sensitive to these other forces of mind, of impelling the mind towards something that we more frequently see, right? Which is this, you know, it's duller, it's more firm, it's more stuck, it's more stubborn, it's more willful, it's trying, right? It's trying to get something, it's trying to make something happen, it's trying to attain or achieve something. And again, like all of these things, you don't beat yourself up for that. You know, of course, you know, we want to be free. We want to be happy. We want to understand what's happening, and we take it seriously. We take, you know, we show up to an intensive retreat, and, you know, we're trying to do our best. And the way we've been trained to do our best is doing that, is like pushing, digging in, you know, getting serious about it. And of course it is serious, but there is this other sense of like, it's a move that can be so counter to so much of our training about how do we relate to life? How do we relate to accomplishment? How do we relate to whatever is arising? And that it's like this sense of without agenda, but just with agility, this sense of trying to really see what's happening and understanding that that takes a lot of energy, but also getting that what's happening is gone right away, right? And then there's something new happening, and there's something new happening, and there's something new happening. That it's the changeability, the movement of life, of experience is so fast that as soon as you kind of get like that around it, it's gone and you're missing it. And so that actually the mind needs this lightness, this levity, this flexibility, this ability to be buoyant with how things are really moving, which is incredibly fast. Just, you know, try, you know, right now, or just, you know, as we go into this evening, really take that, you know, be careful about that. Be careful with ourselves in terms of, where is this extra pressure that's building behind our actions? And to be interested in it, right? It's not just, again, like behavior modification. You have to see it. You have to see the places that this pressure is building around every action and be humbled by it. Right? Every time you take a step, every time you're reaching for, you know, a spoon at the lunch line, every time you're bringing the attention to something, if you're saying, oh, I'm going to follow the breath, notice, you know, notice, is there this pressure building in the mind around that? Or not? Or is there a tenderness building? Is there a lightness? Is there a sense of more the receptivity that we keep trying to emphasize? This openness to it. And the nimbleness of which it takes to really be able to observe some of these very subtle and sensitive forces at play in our lives. Even the metta, you know, that's like sometimes it's so painful. You know, we're trying to offer approaches to the loving kindness practice, to the compassion practice that are very light, right? Very gentle, very not striving, not trying to conjure something, not trying to make something happen. Because you can see, like, you can do that. And there are totally good approaches to those practices that have a little more of that sort of like punch behind them. And there is value to that. But to really, for the context here and for what we're trying to teach and offer and join you all in, is this sense of what is it like to not feel like you're force-feeding yourself loving kindness, right? It's just like, oh, no. It's like we're just attuning, we're sensitizing, we're finding where might there be a sort of natural inclination toward care and tenderness, and where do we find the sort of natural thirst for that, right? That we all have a longing for our own love that actually can be nourished, you know, that can be quenched, and that we have a natural inclination toward the truth, to seeing clearly, but we're not trying to push ourselves, force feed ourselves, you know, force ourselves into, you know, into the muck of it. You don't need to make anything happen. Vipassana is very explicit about just being with whatever is arisen, not trying to find something that isn't readily apparent, right? Not trying to create some state that isn't happening right now, but also not trying to look for something that isn't already arisen. The practice is about being with whatever is arisen right now and trying to watch it as cleanly, as clearly, as carefully as we can as it arises and passes, dependent upon condition. We need the energy, but we almost don't recognize energy that doesn't have a sense of strain around it, right? We think about energy as like one of the seven factors of awakening, you know, automatically there's a stress there so much of the time, like energy, right? There's like, what is that? Why do we get tight when we think of that? What is that contraction in the body when we think about cultivating energy? It's amazing. And to get that actually there's energy in the mind, energy in the body that has nothing to do with that, that's almost irrecognizable in terms of energy until you start to experience it and you have it. You know, you'll wake up at night and you'll have energy for no reason, or you'll be quite quiet and you'll see that there will be energy that will arisen that's very stable and very clean and doesn't have a lot of anxiety around it or doesn't have a lot of force around it. It's quite powerful. It's quite beautiful. But sometimes it's unfamiliar. And so it can be, we don't either acknowledge it, we don't recognize it, or sometimes it can even feel scary. You know, so many of us long for kind of the intensity of enlightenment, you know, the sense of like that our clarity is just going to be like, you know, or our loving kindness is just going to be, you know, just like blow everyone away, you know? And, you know, there's a beautiful thirst in that really of just like, oh, like understanding that the mind, the capacity of our kindness, the capacity of our wisdom actually can be beyond the normal boundaries of what we encounter in the mind and the body. But, you know, you think about like the sun, you know, the sense of all the great, powerful light of the sun and how it illuminates everything on earth. But to really also get that while it's doing that, it's obscuring the heavens. You know, think about how much of this universe we can't see when the sun is there because of its just ferocious brightness. You know, is that the only quality that we value in our own hearts, our own minds? Where do we recognize the beauty of the quietude, of the darkness, of the softer places, of a very, this tenderness and the supple tenderness that can be there of the mind? I think of Sayadaw Ulakana at the Chazua Monastery, and, you know, there are just like, you know, many ways that you could talk about his greatness as a teacher and his versatility with the Dhamma and all of the good acts he's done. And yet I realized years after he's gone, the thing that sticks with me the most was just this very simple tenderness he had. You know, he was such a gentle person, and his voice was so gentle, and his way was so gentle. And it's like, why do we long for something more than that? Right? What is the ego or the arrogance or the ambition more than just this like very simple tenderness of heart and of relationship? You know, sometimes we can get lost in our practice, and, you know, we get, some of it's inspired, but some of it is also just like out of balance. And so where can we just come back into the humbleness and the beauty of a simple, beautiful gesture, right? One simple step. One beautiful movement, one rising of the abdomen, one falling of the abdomen, not need more for validation of the value of the practice. There was a nun during the time of the Buddha named Upalavana, who was one of many who became fully enlightened. And she was walking in the forest one day, and Mara, the kind of personification of evil and ill will and kind of rascal, always trying to get people to fall from grace, finds her out there and tries to distract her. And so she says to herself, "Now who is this? This is Mara, the evil one, desiring to make me fall from concentration." Then the bhikkhuni Upalavana, having understood, "This is Mara, the evil one," replied to him in verse, which I think enlightened people do all the time. "Though 100,000 rogues, just like you, might come here, I stir not a hair. I feel no terror. Even alone, Mara, I don't fear you. I can make myself disappear, or I can enter inside your belly. I can stand between your eyebrows, and you won't catch a glimpse of me. I am the master of my own mind. The bases of power are well developed. I am freed from every kind of bondage. Therefore, I don't fear you, friend." And then Mara, the evil one, realizing that the bhikkhuni Upalavana knows me, sad and disappointed, disappeared right there. I think there's just something so moving about that. Just that utter confidence of her total sense of capacity of mind, right? Of just no fear, no terror, and no ill will. Right, even like all of these things of like, I'm not afraid of you, this, you know, this, like this very, you know, potential threat, the total security in her capacity and the freedom from all kinds of bondage, and then including to call him friend at the end, right? To understand that there's just like, there's not even ill will, there's like no resentment. How free that is, how secure that is, how beautiful that is. And how that really, it's just a matter of this training, of this capacity to be with what is arising, to be with what's happening. And the mind slowly, slowly starts to become more and more familiar with all of the terrain of the mind and body. Totally versatile in every place, no matter what is arising. Right? It doesn't mean that Mara goes away. It doesn't mean that unpleasant experiences never happen. But it means when they do, they're not threatening in any way, right? There's total confidence in the mind's ability to be with them with clarity and kindness and confidence. And so when we're sitting, you know, it's just to remember that is playing out in the most mundane ways. You encounter sleepiness, and to recognize that is totally worth being in relationship with, completely worth building understanding with. What is low energy? What is sleepiness? What is sloth? What is torpor? What does it feel like in the body? What are the thoughts like? What's the quality of mind? Again, you know, when we're sleepy, there's almost always calm, which is one of the seven factors of enlightenment, you know? And we don't value it. We don't appreciate it. And it's like, wow, can you build with the strength? Can you recognize like, oh, okay, there's this, and there isn't a lot of energy, right? And it's like, okay, who cares? No problem. You know, if we can't be with a little bit of low energy, how are we going to be when we're dying? We'll probably be tired. Right? It's probably not going to be like our most perfect conditions of body and mind. And that's the training. Right? When there's restlessness, when you want to run out of the hall, it's too much. It's like, okay, great, restlessness. It's not the obstacle. It's not the thing that's in the way of where you should be or want to be or think you are. It's what's happening. What is it like? What does it feel like in the mind? What does it feel like in the body? You know, sense desire, ill will, doubt, boredom, whatever. You know, with all these things, can we be genuinely interested in them? Take them seriously, honor them as parts of the experience of being. Recognize them, value them, bring them in, try to build relationship with them as hard as they are. And then when they're too hard, right, moving away. Being very careful about our energies and this balance of it. Our the island that Michelle and I both live on is called Hawaii Island. And on the far side of the island, there's a volcano that's still very active and governed by this deity, Pele, this deva. And many people have heard that, you know, last year she was quite active and there was a lot of eruption and a lot of lava coming out in that part of the island. And just about 10 months ago, it really quieted down. And recently, we were able to go over to the other side of the island and visit and check it out and to just really see how, it was so powerful to be in by the caldera and in the general region where, you know, just so many months ago, there was just like such ferocious and intense, powerful activity. And now it just was so quiet. There was a kind of calm and sort of a sleepiness and restfulness that was just much more powerful than I anticipated. It wasn't just a non-lava, right? It wasn't just a non-eruption. It was a positive of this other thing, this quietude. And then when we were driving back, you have to go over between these two mountains, Mauna Kea, Mauna Loa. And starting that trip, I looked and, you know, we still had about half a tank of gas. And I figured, okay, that's fine. You know, it's only, by time, it's fine. But not by scale, right? And I before we even got to the top, the gas light went on. And I was like, gosh, I was like, maybe it's just because we're like this, you know, and like tank is tilted or whatever. And it was like, we got to the top and it was still on. And I was like, you know, anyway. So there was a sense of, there was still like another hour and a half to drive, you know. And I had the idea of just putting it in neutral and realizing that from there, we basically just coasted down the mountain, you know, for like an hour. And it worked, and it was a little hair-raising, you know. There's not a lot really around there that would have been a hard place to, yeah, be stuck. But anyway, we weren't stuck. We made it down the mountain, and so there was something about it, of course, that was very powerful to me in terms of aspects of this practice, of really understanding that there are times where we really feel like we're trying to get to this summit, and we understand that it takes a lot of energy, like more energy than we sometimes imagined, especially if this is like your first retreat, and your friends think you're at like a spa, you know, and like, how's your meditation retreat? It's like, oh my God, you know, like, there's no way to even describe it, right? So this sense of like, wow, this is actually... Where's the sauna or whatever, right? This is a lot of work. And that there's a way that, you know, in periods of my life and practice and in many of all of ours, of like where it just, you're putting in a lot of energy and then you get to a certain place and you realize that you can't do it anymore, that there's a violence to it, that you've run out of gas, that there's just something in there that you can't strive anymore. And so that this value of then just like letting go, and just like putting the mind, putting, you know, in neutral and just letting it kind of slide down the mountain, like letting phenomena just unfold on their own. And to know that like that there might be times on your retreat where that it feels like that's the dynamic, where there's like times of more energy, times of less energy, and that you're sort of going up to the summit and coming down from the summit. But also to really get that it doesn't always need to be like that either. That the energy can be much more balanced in general, right? There doesn't always have to be the extreme between, you know, intense energy and non-doing, right? That there can be a sense of like, we're not just summiting and coming down from the mountain. That as you sit here and you close your eyes and you're with the body and with the mind, that you know that this is the mountain, right? That every experience that you're feeling, it is the rivers and the, you know, the valleys and the peaks and the summits and the moss and the muck and the snakes and the, you know, chipmunks and all of the life and the birth, life and death, the becoming and the non-becoming, the creation and the disintegration that we experience right now in the present moment is the process, is life, is being. There isn't anywhere to go, to climb, to get up to, nothing to attain beyond simply just being with and understanding, oh, this is what this mountain feels like right now. This is what this mountain feels like right now. And building a relationship, deepening and deepening with that unfolding process. So I'll just end with these words of the Buddha, the Bhaddhekarata Sutta. He says, "Let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let them see each presently arisen state. Let them know that and be sure of it. Invincibly, unshakably. Today, the effort must be made. Tomorrow, death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, by day, by night, it is they, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night." Let's just sit for a moment. So we have some time for walking meditation, and at 9 o'clock, again, we'll have the metta chanting and short sit. And no, if you weren't able to make it last night but are coming tonight, we have more copies of the chant right here, so you can grab them on the steps. Have a good walking period.